Thank you. So you heard two great talks from states describing the various ways they implemented H1N1 vaccination. And what I want to do is go from a broader perspective about what were some of those influences that made Tennessee do what Tennessee did, and Washington do what Washington did, and Alaska do what Alaska did, and New Hampshire do what New Hampshire did. And so that was the fun that we had from September through February with our team at the University of Michigan talking with folks week after week. As you know, it was a federal structure for H1N1 vaccine with a flexible implementation at the program level. Because there was no existing mechanism to track implementation across states, we jumped in to fill that gap, and our team again collected data. We tried to do this collaboratively. We tried to, in close to real time, feed information back to the states and to CDC so people could keep track during those many frantic weeks and months of what their peers were doing across the country to kind of place themselves in the spectrum of strategies that were used, and now trying to pull information together and learn some lessons. So my purpose today is to describe some of the key influences on state implementation. So the first key influence that I want to talk about is goals. States described, and these sometimes were very well articulated and sometimes were somewhat understated, but states did have varying goals for their campaigns. An example is making vaccine available to whoever wants it, vaccinating as many people as possible, vaccinating high-risk individuals first. Goals establish the perspective for key decisions, and you can look at these three goals and imagine how they might translate into different implementation strategies. So if you take the first one, making vaccine available to whoever wants it, that really suggests a focus on public access, maybe walk-in hours, doing things more in the public domain. And if you compare that, for example, to a goal of vaccinating high-risk individuals first, that suggests a little bit more active targeted outreach, efforts to push on physicians to identify and vaccinate their high-risk patients, or special efforts to motivate the high-risk patients to seek vaccination. In no way am I trying to say one is the right answer or one is better than another, but you can see how if a state had a particular goal that their implementation strategies would then follow. A huge influence on how this played out across states was varying public health capacity. There are states with almost no public health departments. There are states with city or county or regional health departments that are really agents of the state health department and operate very centrally through a very streamlined approach. And then there are those that have city or county or regional health departments that are very autonomous. When we talk about just sheer numbers, we range from, South Dakota that has one local health department in Sioux Falls and nothing anywhere else, to Massachusetts that has their 350 kind of cities and towns, each with their own existing structure and everything in between, and with a variety of service delivery across those health departments. Another example is, Kansas with their 105 autonomous health districts to Utah with their 7 regions. Again, if you think about this, you can understand how that local public health structure and capacity would influence implementation. So, giving some examples. Local public health capacity would affect how much vaccination can reasonably be expected to occur in public venues and through mass vaccination clinics. Higher capacity might mean more can be done in the public setting. Lower capacity means we got to find some partners, we got to find some other avenues. Public health capacity affects how much school vaccination can be done by public health. And again, do we find other partners? Do we say this isn't a feasible strategy? The implementation strategies follow this capacity question. The sheer number of public health partners affects things like the amount of communication needed, the amount of state assistance needed, the time for state-level staff to work with individual public health entities to bring them on board. And of course, the question of centralized local public health structure versus autonomous public health really affects the whole decision-making process, whether decisions are made at the top and the information communicated downward across the public health units, or whether there's really a need for some sort of collaborative, collective decision-making requiring a different investment of time and effort to come bring people together. Information infrastructure was a huge factor in what people were able to do, and certainly states began this campaign with highly variable information infrastructure. And that's everything from the immunization information systems or registries that Jan just gave a great example of, to databases of providers that a few states had but most didn't, even to communication systems, things interesting as Hawaii being able to have a conference call with all their providers because of their logistical challenges, to I think it was California had a system where they couldn't generate mass emails after they placed an order because their system was capped on the number that could go at one time, and so they had to do batches. It played out hundreds of ways. I think we could sit here and come up with example after example of the way information infrastructure sometimes facilitated and often impeded the efficient movement of the campaign. States had highly variable IT support, and the states that have it were very appreciative of it, and the states that didn't have it really lamented it and understand that they need to make some efforts. So again, you can see, and I think the talks that we just heard provided some really good examples of how information infrastructure was so important. When you think about that registration system that Beth Ann talked about, that didn't exist. So that was something that had to be created. It had to be created quickly. It had to have a much bigger capacity. We were talking, for most states, 2 and 3 times the number of H1N1 providers as VFC providers. That's a big increase. The fields, collecting the fields, facility type, that was all new, that people had to think that through and make sure we had the right categories. There was a lot of adjusting on the fly, shipping information, other details. When it worked sort of at optimal efficiency, the information systems for registration, allocation, ordering, and doses administered were part of one integrated system. That was the exception. When people were lucky, the systems for registration and allocation and ordering and doses administered could at least talk to each other. For most folks, that wasn't the case, and it was sort of a piecemeal. They might have had a good information system over here, and sometimes data could be exported over there, but very often there was a lot of manual work required to link those systems. So again, when we think about what people were able to do and the strategies that they chose, part of that was the pressure of time and knowing that these pieces of information needed to go different places. And that was actually quite a big factor. States also came into this with a lot of variation in their existing relationships with other immunization providers and settings. Hospitals were a kind of a unique situation where many of them were already involved in emergency preparedness activities, already meeting with state preparedness folks, and so they were relatively easy to bring on board. Now, they had other issues, including, Jan did a good discussion of what do you do with an entity that's so big and has sites all over the place in different counties and maybe sometimes centralized, sometimes not. And we also had the huge issue of acceptance of LAIV at a lot of hospitals. But bringing them on board most places was relatively easy. Adult immunization providers, pretty new for folks. Often it was difficult to even get a list of who they are, to try to compile that. The relationships with their professional organizations sometimes existed, often didn't. Pharmacies and community vaccinators, again, in some states there were strong relationships with those entities, and in other places none. And for schools, there were programs that were fortunate enough to have been doing seasonal flu vaccine programs in schools already, and they could build their H1N1 school efforts right on top of that. Some states were at a point where they were beginning a new school vaccine requirement or had other programs in the schools, so they had those contacts, they had those relationships started, and they could move on that. But a lot of folks were starting at ground zero with the schools. They hadn't been doing anything in the schools for years, and all of this had to happen as part of a new working relationship. And sometimes things worked out, and very often folks found that they were not able to overcome some of the barriers that were there. I want to mention one other thing here in terms of variation with existing, with other state agencies. That was also something that was highly variable. Jan, I think you showed a slide at the beginning that had all the different entities that you were working with. And you were in a nice place because you had some relationships formed. It was quite different from state to state. Some folks had already been working with their emergency preparedness people, had a committee going, were already meeting. That wasn't the case everywhere. Some folks had been working with education or licensure. Some folks got a list of all licensed physicians in the state. Other folks couldn't get that, had to pay for it, got a no response. It just, every aspect of this program pertained to a different state agency, and so the folks that had some established relationships were really in a nice position to be able to draw on those. So some lessons learned. Flexibility in implementation of H1N1 vaccination was absolutely essential to accommodate these variations that I just talked about, these existing state differences, and then allow for different choices that could build on strengths and maybe make up for some weaknesses or go around some barriers. States are now at a position or at a point where they can build on the gains that they made, and there were gains in a lot of areas, and it's not just all about what was your final coverage rate. A lot of this was about where do you have some potential new partners? You know, new specialty groups, breaking into new settings, developing some advances in the information systems, whether it's bringing new people onto the registry or having a new mass vaccination platform to allow people to put information into the registry easier, to have a new tracking system, a new ability to communicate efficiently with providers, all sorts of things like that. I want to acknowledge our team at the University of Michigan, Ann Cowan, Brian McElvain, Gary Freed, Claire Hannon and Caitlin Wells at Ames helped us, and I see a lot of folks out here that answered our calls week after week and helped us out with this. And again, we're just very proud of the very successful efforts, and we recognize how well people were able to build off of what existed in their states and to very quickly and very creatively innovate to make H1N1 vaccine happen in their own states. So congratulations.
Thank you, Sarah. At this time, we'll take questions. Are there any questions? No questions? Come on. Well, I actually have a question for our panelists here, and specifically both to Beth Ann and to Jan. How did you balance the demand between the public side versus whether or not you were going to give to private physicians? I know that was a really critical decision early on, and how did your respective states make that decision?
Well, we actually didn't make a strict division like that. We had the majority of our childhood vaccines are given in the private sector anyway, and we knew that our private partners were really the place where particularly young people, lots of people are used to getting their seasonal flu in private areas, and so we really didn't say we didn't worry about balancing it. We really worried about how we're going to reach the people in the state of Washington and make sure they had access to vaccine. And we are a local control state, so some jurisdictions really managed they centrally distributed vaccine after they got it from us. But again, the balance was really toward how do we make sure we get our target populations covered and where do they get vaccinated.
I think in Tennessee we had many of the similar efforts, just getting to getting to the target populations more so than deciding in between certain providers and the public.
We have our first question.
Yes, I'm Laura Harrod from Kentucky, and I have a question for Jan, and is it Beth Ann?
That's me.
Okay. I've got to get the name messed up. We got really far behind when we were doing H1N1, and we did the VFC and the H1N1, and we did the ARRA, and all those things hit at the same time, seasonal flu, everything you were mentioning, I was going, yes, yes, yes. And we were overwhelmed, and we were working, 18-hour days also. And I want to know, are you all caught up yet? I still feel so far behind. I still feel overwhelmed that I'm not caught up to a point where I feel like I can say it's over with. It still doesn't feel over with. I still feel like I'm not getting everything done. Are you all caught up?
Are any of us ever all caught up? I will just have to say it was a real struggle, especially during the heat of H1N1. We were fortunate in being able to secure some emergency preparedness funds and bring on some temporary staff to help with the H1N1 vaccine ordering. And then my core staff provided a lot of support and training and backup, and that helped having those staff. We had a halftime person that dealt with doses administered reporting. But I will tell you, I didn't take any time off until the end of December, and I was so fried. I mean, people were actually wondering if I was going to come back. It was really, really hard, and it was hard on my staff too, even though we had extra help, and I'm not sure how it played out in other states. As far as being caught up, I feel pretty good today. We had three full-time staff that helped with H1N1 vaccine ordering, and we had the half-time staff person did doses administered, and we had a set time. They left our charge March 31st was their last day. They really didn't do much VFC work, our core team, and I don't really have a very big team there. Two primary staff that work on vaccine ordering and distribution, and myself and another staff person that do pretty much everything else. But I felt like we were able to keep up, and I don't know if it was just, we drove ourselves into the ground doing it or what, but.
Laura.
In all the discussions about how different groups did this, I haven't heard anybody address something that I wonder if either one of you can tell me what you did. When providers first registered and they said, we want 40 doses of this or 150 of that, and then you sent out that first order, and I know, Beth Ann, you were showing how in Tennessee you're macro deducted from that. Did you have any additional feedback loop? I mean, maybe that provider, for a variety of reasons, didn't want as much as they had originally said anymore, and how did you determine that before you sent more vaccine?
Absolutely. One thing I didn't mention in my talk is when the providers or facilities originally ordered, or their initial order, we sent out email confirmation. So our first kind of feedback for ourselves was to make sure they really wanted exactly how many doses they ordered on their online form. And so we made sure they confirmed their order the first time. And then once they started receiving vaccine and they decided they had had enough, they didn't need any more, the demand was not there, they could email the department. We set up a email address specifically for H1N1 vaccine, and they could email us, cancel their order, reduce their order, and we had a couple of, we hired two temps that their one of their primary job was to man this email and update the database with the reduced or canceled orders.
We actually managed ordering a little bit differently. We really did pretty much real-time ordering, so we didn't have a list of what their total request was. We did ask that information because we wanted to assess what the demand might be, but we managed orders based on what we had allocated and available, and we also required them to submit inventory on hand and the doses used, and we do that for our childhood program too, so that we could make decisions, and local health primarily making the decision about where that provider was with their usage so they could determine how best to manage that order.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Perilla from Minnesota. I have a question for Sarah, and to start with, I just wanted to say thank you. It was always such a pleasure speaking with you, and it's great to get this data back. I just wanted to get what you thought was kind of the number of grantees that were using immunization as the lead agency for vaccine ordering and distribution versus emergency preparedness.
For the vaccine part, most were using immunization as the lead agency, definitely not all. And I would say pretty variable in terms of maybe how autonomous immunization was even when they were the lead. Sometimes it was because there was a very collaborative, in a very positive way, a very collaborative group that was involved in talking through the allocation process and setting the framework for, okay, here's what we're going to try to do. Sometimes it was a little less positive, where people felt either from above a lack of autonomy, or maybe because of the broader structure of H1N1, not necessarily limited to vaccine, the broader H1N structured, felt a little constrained in different ways. I would say that was the exception rather than the rule, but it did occur. So typically the lead, often a lot of independence, but not always. But I want to make sure that I point out, there were a lot of positive, collaborative relationships there. One thing that I think happened in very many places is that the preparedness folks learned that immunization people know some things that are really helpful when you're talking about flu vaccine that preparedness folks didn't know before this. And immunization people learned that preparedness folks have their own areas of expertise, and immunization people can learn from that too. And so the tenor of the conversation and the descriptions maybe changed as the months went along, and maybe not everybody appreciated those different helpful expertises, if that's a word, at the beginning. But I think they do now, and I think that's a healthy thing. Again, when you talk about building going forward, that's gotta be a good thing, I think.
Thanks, Sarah. Well, we have reached the end of our hour, and this is the conclusion of the session. Thank you all for being here, and thanks to our presenters.